I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Sanjeev Sahota on my left, immediately on my left, was born in Derbyshire and now lives in Sheffield. His debut novel, Hours of the Streets, published in 2011, is the story of a homegrown radicalisation and a terror attack on the streets of Sheffield, and was called nothing short of extraordinary by The Observer and a moral work of real intelligence and power by The Times. His second novel, The Year of the Runaways, which focused on a group of mainly Indian migrant workers, also based in Sheffield, was acclaimed by Carmela Shamsi as a beautiful and brilliant novel, superbly well-drawn and of our time by The Telegraph and compelling by The Financial Times. As well as winning the EUPL in 2017, it won the South Bank Sky Arts Award for Literature, the Encore Award for Second Novel, and was also shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2015. And in 2013, Sanjeev was named as one of Granta Magazine's best young British novelists. Evie Wild, my far left, was born in London and grew up in Australia and South London. She studied creative writing at Bath Spa and Goldsmiths University. Her first novel, After the Fire, A Still Small Voice, published in 2009, won the John Llewellyn Rees Prize and a Betty Trask Award, was shortlisted for the Orange Prize for New Writers, the Commonwealth Prize, and the International Dublin Literary Award. In 2013, like Sanjeev, Evie was included on Granta Magazine's Once a Decade Best Young British Novelist list. Her second novel was published in 2013, All the Birds Singing. The Encore Award, there's so many accolades for both these writers, and the Jerwood Fiction Uncovered Prize, also the EUPL. It was shortlisted for the Costa Novel Prize, the James Tate Black Prize, the Sky Arts Times Breakthrough Award, a long list of the Stella Prize and the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. Evie's been acclaimed as a writer who reconfigures the conventions of storytelling with sure-footedness and ambition. And she also runs Review, a small independent bookshop in Peckham in South London. And Evie and Sanjeev are both going to read from their prize-winning books. And I didn't actually ask you, would you like to go first?
Sure. Right. So I'm going to read from, there are two narratives in this. One takes place in the UK and one takes place in Australia. I'm going to read from the Australian bit because it's warm. And it's a bit grotty. There's a young woman who's been working on the streets in Darwin, and one of her regular customers propositions her to come and live with him as a sort of maid with benefits on his lovely sheep farm. And she gets there, and of course it's a sort of hellhole, and she's kind of held prisoner, but without, you know, without bars. And this is the first time she's met sheep and felt a felt empathy for sheep, you know. So there's this pen of, he's sort of said he's got this lovely sheep farm. There's a pen of withering sheep out the back. I wonder how those sheep are still alive, how long they've been trapped there next to their slaughterhouse. Since Carole left, I don't know how long that has been. The pen is made up of flimsy metal barriers that can be linked or separated and moved one at a time. The sections are not heavy, and the sheep, if they had a mind to, could probably break out. But they don't do a lot of anything much, just shift their weight from their hips to their shoulders and stare out at the horizon while the flies eat their backsides. The earth in their enclosure is coated in shit, and just a few feet from the left of their pen is a dusting at least of grass. I start to shift the pen, panel by panel, expanding it slightly, edging the sheep over towards the grass. When they get in my way, I herd and shoo them, waving my arms. They are not bothered enough to be scared, but they more or less go where I tell them. They move with the weight of ghosts, and I noticed a few are resting on the front joints of their legs, like they haven't got the strength to stand. It takes me 2 hours, during which time Otto and Kelly drive up to see why I've been gone so long. Otto frowns at first, but then he shrugs. Might get some meat on them, I suppose. And he drives back to the house, while Kelly watches out the back of the ute. The flies drink out the corners of my eyes and crawl over my shoulders, and I let them crawl. I'm not sure what I was expecting, to see the sheep dance gratefully around in the puny grass I found them. But they just stand there, a silent little group. I try to move them about, but they're not scared of me. Resigned is what they are, and I tell them, you can move around if you want to, waving my arms and jumping about, but they just sway a little in the hot fly air. I look at the wool shed and see the meat hook, and I shift onto my other foot. Fair enough, I say, and cycle back to the house and put the sheep far in the back crevice of my mind with those other things that come only out in the dark when my guard is down and I stare at the night behind my window cage.
Hi everyone. I'm going to read a page or so set in India, and it's a young man called Dodji who's come to meet a travel agent who's going to help his way across to Europe. Shivroop Sky Travel, a small glass-fronted building with a life-size cutout of an air stewardess in the doorway. Dodji pushed inside, into the freeze of the air conditioning. A dark woman, perfect strip of vermilion in her parting, looked up from behind her desk. She asked if she could help. She didn't smile. I'm here to see Mr. Tipperedi. And what is it in connection with? I'm here to see him about flights abroad. She sighed, seeming to understand, and leaned heavily to one side, perhaps pressing a button. Several minutes passed before a man stepped through the curtain at the back of the office. He was short, even darker than the woman, and with a jumped-up little moustache whose tips pointed to God. The woman said something in Tamil, and then the man clicked his fingers and told Dodji to come upstairs. An hour later, and Dodji was back on the street, his money satchel lighter. 2 weeks, the man had said. He'd called someone in Delhi and said that Dodji could be on a flight to Turkey in exactly 2 weeks. After that, he'd be trucked as far as Paris, which was in France, and from there Dodji would be on his own. Did he understand? Yes, Dodji said. Of course, I'll come with you as far as Delhi, part of the service. And then Mr. Tipperedi took out some forms from his little Tamil drawer and snatched up the pen leaking in his shirt pocket. There was a map on the wall behind him. Where is France on there? Dodji asked. Mr. Tipperedi twisted round. Oh, no. France is in Europe. That is South India. I am from... He reached back and jabbed his pen into the map. There, Kanyakumari, the southernmost tip of India, the end of the country. Dodji nodded. It is the only point in the world where three oceans meet. So you see, it was in my blood to help people straddle the seas. He gave a little laugh. It sounded like something he said quite often. Anyway, I expect you will be wanting to make payment. I'll leave it there.
Books, they're actually on display and for sale behind us. I'd like to start off by asking each of you what winning the European Prize for Literature meant for you as writers.
Well, for me, it's meant a sort of really nice broadening of, you know, you write a novel at home on your own in a little room and you don't speak to anyone, and the idea that people you don't know are reading it is quite an odd thing. You know, there's a moment when it's not just like your mum and your partner who've read it, and you can't name the people who've read it, and then to think that it then goes on to be translated and people are reading it in different countries, that it's really, it kind of blows your mind a little bit.
So you're no longer the sheep stuck in the metaphorically,
yeah,
anyway.
Dying.
Yeah, for me, it's facilitated a great deal of movement in the kind of the translations, in the translation markets. My first novel wasn't translated at all, actually, and my second novel wasn't. And then this prize came along. And since it, and as a direct consequence of it, I'd even go as far to say there, I think there's been eight to ten translation deals, but especially in the Eastern Bloc. And that kind of, you know, it is just amazing to think that a book you write on your own in your room in Sheffield is suddenly reaching out to people in Albania or Serbia. And so that's been quite a wonderful consequence of directly of the prize, I think.
And do you think that's because of with your book particularly, which deals with obviously migrants, and that's one of the, you know, refugees, it's one of the big topic of our times. Do you think that's why they're sold in those particular, you know, rights are sold in those particular countries?
Yeah, perhaps it's brought, the prize has given attention to the novel in those particular territories. So, and perhaps it has, does have certain resonance in Greece or in Italy, because it does seem to be a topic of the time. Although I'd argue it's always been there. And now there's perhaps just like the topic's always been there, or, you know, if it's timely, it's been timely for 2,000 years. But now there just seems there's some particular attention on it, and perhaps that's had some reason why that's been picked up in certain countries, in Turkey, Greece, Croatia, those kind of places.
And what sort of reactions have you had to? I mean, I think you've had about 10.
I've had 18.
Right. 18?
Yeah.
Counts the countries in Europe.
That's been unbelievable. I think my first book was translated into maybe four. Mm. So that's definitely a direct result of the prize.
And do you feel, both of you, that you have to be translated to be successful as a writer, depending on what that kind of tangible success means to you?
No, it didn't. I mean, nothing really changes what I think of myself as a writer. I think, you know, whether you're shortlisted or you win or you're translated, you're still, you know, you still think you're a rubbish writer. That's just the way it is. So it doesn't change how I feel about myself as a writer or my work, or it doesn't make the next work any easier or harder, actually. I don't feel any particular increase in pressure. It's just always just coming to meet the page on the day and do it, and learning from the page, I think was what Evie said earlier. So I don't think it changes how I view myself or any other writers.
Do you think, because there's been such a focus on literature and translation, well, just perhaps it seems to me in my narrow little world in recent years, with the sort of huge impact of the change of the Man Booker Prize being an international prize for fiction, and authors such as Elena Ferrante, Karla Wicknausgaard, and now Olga Tokarczuk, Polish novelist who won the Man Booker International Prize last week. Do you think this makes a difference in terms of our recognition of writing and translation here in the UK? Do you think publishers are more likely to take a chance on an unknown writer?
I'd hope so. I don't know if it translates into actual sales. I mean, I know in my bookshop it has made us focus more, I think, on works in translation, but we're a very small shop, so I don't know. I wouldn't say that works in translation sell a huge amount unless we kind of really push them.
So it's kind of hand selling. Yeah. Interestingly, Elena Ferrante, is my brilliant friend, was the top fiction seller in translation in 2015. So that kind of beat the Stieglarsens and the Nosebos. So that obviously is some kind of trickle down effect or a word of mouth effect.
I think translation is still about 3% of our the books that are sold in the UK. So for me it speaks to the kind of the arrogance we have in this country, our literary culture has in particular, about works in translation and how the value we put on English language stuff or stuff that comes from America. We seem to have this massive crush on American fiction, or we'll publish anything that comes from there, it feels to me. But with our neighbours in Europe, we're less open to, and I think that's to our detriment, because the works I read I mean, it's a function of what gets translated, I guess, but the works I read in translation are, you know, it's not just that the stories are different because, you know, they're about people with a different, slightly different culture to ours, but just they're written differently and they speak to you differently and they move you in different ways in the way that, like, English language fiction doesn't do. So I think that there's a massive gap there in our own sort of being of ourselves.
And how much do you think that gap might increase with, I hate to mention the spectre of Brexit, but we're going to be talking a little bit more about that later.
I don't know, because I think you get the literature you deserve, and I think currently, I do think, you know, this sort of arrogance that I have, I think our culture is currently particularly open towards Europe, our literary culture is particularly open to Europe, so I don't see how that would change. I love a historical novel as much as anyone, but the way we seem to be enthralled to them, instead of, you know, perhaps instead of books set in the contemporary world and, you know, the way we're living and the way we're speaking and the way we are actually being.
That's interesting because the Golden Booker shortlist, which was announced this week, was entirely composed, I think, of historical novels.
That doesn't surprise me.
No. And perhaps that's part of the nostalgia that we seem to be.
Brexit's kind of like it's kind of, you know, the death rattle of empire, just like the final gasp before perhaps like those feelings wash you and we start realizing that we are no more relevant than any other country in Europe, or no more superior to any other country, or no more, you know, we seem to still carry this feeling that we're a huge superpower and hugely relevant in the world. And I think it's perhaps Brexit is the last point at which we might think that.
How do you feel about that? Because you're half Australian and your books are set sort of partially, particularly the last one partially in the UK and partially in Australia. How do you feel about that sort of last gasp of empire and what it's kind of meaning? Apparently we're set to do lots of deals with Commonwealth countries while obviously deporting Commonwealth citizens.
Yeah. I mean, I think the UK and Australia, it feels a bit like out of the frying pan into the fire in that respect. It's I look at my mother-in-law's bookshelf, and she is a Brexit voter.
Oh.
And also Polish.
Oh.
Doesn't make much sense. And she's got Richard and Judy's novels on there, and not much else.
Have they written
them? And a lot of historical stuff, and so for me that's like a kind of little microcosm of the people who vote for that kind of stuff. And yeah, I think you're right, and you get the literature you deserve.
But how so, sort of on that theme about identity as well, because that's what, you know, the whole Brexit movement is supposed to be about, restoring our national identity, whatever that is. And you've said you dream about Australia all the time. And, you know, your books are about British Asian in the first book and migrant families, migrant individuals on the other. How important do you feel it is to you as writers? Are you writing about your own identities when you're writing novels? I mean, obviously there's a kind of fictional overlay. How important it is to you to kind of explore that in your books?
I don't consciously explore my own. Your whole life kind of comes into every novel, like your experience of life, because it can't not really. But I don't consciously kind of sit there and think,
you're going to write the great Australian novel.
Yeah, or this is my post-Brexit novel. You know, I'm not, in my writing, I feel like it's not that poised. It's more a sort of jumble of stories, which of course are affected by my surroundings, but the anger and the sadness of Brexit and that sort of thing kind of come into it in different ways, I think.
Yeah, I think my identity is a prism through which I write, but I think books inevitably just get refracted in different ways and go off, you know, they lose their base and they go off where they're going to go, which may be quite far from any kind of identity or any sense of myself that I might have. But one thing that does sort of interest me is that my books, the first two anyway, are very much sort of rooted in the individual or a sense of, you know, an individual identity, even though the second novel might be an ensemble cast, it's still very much about ideas of individualism. And one thing I really like about sort of the books that I've read from Europe in translation is actually you see so many more. This is what I meant when I said there's different ways of there's books that seem to be differently written. That there's kind of a collective conscience that play off. So I'm thinking of books like Saramago's Blindness, or you know, anything by Jenny Erpenbeck. Well, I read a great slim book by a Catalan writer recently, Mercè Rodoredo's Death in Spring.
Oh yeah, and though, get some great recommendations here.
But they're less about sort of an individual conscience, and you can sense like there's a collective community sort of at play here, or being spoken about here, and that sense of moral weight that comes with that kind of fiction. I see it in like books I've read in translation, but I don't see it in the UK so much. So I think that's something I really get from European, and also European writers seem to understand much more that people are perverse and people act in ways that are against their best interests. Whereas in the UK, we seem to think novels sent much more ideas of empathy and actually understanding the other, which is great, and that's one function of a novel. But people are also, you know, weird and will do awful things for the sake of it. There's that novel I read, Could Lullaby, a few months ago.
Yeah.
And that seems to speak to that. And I think European writers understand that part of the human condition, in my opinion, much more than I see UK writers doing. So there's different ways of seeing, which I think if we don't cross that line, we won't fully understand ourselves, I guess.
So I think I caught a glimpse, mercifully brief, of Salman Rushdie on Channel 4 last night, talking about the great cultural divide. And he was referring both to Trump's America and to Brexit. Do you have a sense of this great cultural divide that's either upon us or is about to be upon us? And I know this is a really big, lofty question, but how much responsibility does a writer have to address it and even attempt to bridge it?
I mean, the sort of tail between the legs answer is probably no. I don't feel my job is to address it because I'm not educated enough and clever enough to address it properly. You know, it's like any other, I don't mind, I'll reflect stuff in my book, but the idea of having a sort of didactic kind of author voice, like a sort of telling the reader what is right and, you know, a kind of moral voice, it's just not appealing to me. I'm interested in human beings at a much more kind of sort of prehistoric level in a way. And I'm sure, you know, it will be in later books, it will be reflected because of the change in atmosphere in the UK, the change in people's attitudes and the anger and the sadness. Again, that can't help but be reflected. But I don't think I would ever sit down to write something deliberately kind of, you know, triumphant in that way, because I don't think I'm capable of it.
Same. So, I don't know if there's a great cultural divide, but I mean, Trump, he's dangerous and ridiculous and easy to mock, but I'm not sure if he would, you know, was he any worse than, you know, what was done in the Iraq War by George Bush Jr., when millions died?
It's too early to say because he hasn't been in the White
House. I suppose we need to give him time
to wreck everything.
But I don't feel any. I don't feel a responsibility. Actually, no. I don't know about a responsibility, but as a writer, I'm interested in speaking directly to the town that I live in,
which you have done.
Yeah,
quite
and I think
specifically
I'll,
with your two books.
Yeah, and I think I'll. I'm never say never and never say always, but I think that will continue because that's. Partly because I don't feel a particular connection or a strong enough connection to either the history of England or the history of India, which is where my parents are from. So I've got no other kind of environment to locate myself in other than the present. So I think by default, to an extent, I'll always be speaking to the world I'm walking around in.
Yeah. I have to bang on about the Brexit question again. But actually, it really struck me. I was reading a review of Hours of the Streets, your first incendiary in so many ways novel. And the review quotes, the quote is, "The felt loss of belonging, the aching absence of a real past, and the corresponding urge to build a substitute narrative." This was about a young man, Imtiaz, who's been radicalised and sort of is a would-be suicide bomber, essentially. But it actually struck me that it could also be a narrative around Brexit. And I just wondered, sort of, our sort of maybe we could talk about Brexit forever, and I wish we wouldn't have to, but how much do you think it will affect literature in terms of cultural practice? And do we actually care about it? Do we care about this enough? As do you care about it enough as writers? Just in terms of your own, you know, specific.
I don't. Like, the fear is one thing that kind of seeps into everything, but I feel like it's gonna, you know, literature has survived this far. It's not gonna wither on the tree, and I don't know. It seems like, I don't know.
Yeah, not Brexit in isolation, but as a coalition of lots of other things that perhaps are going, that are happening in the world at the moment, whether it's what's happening in, you know, Russia or in America or, you know, Middle East, and perhaps not even those individual things, but kind of the atmosphere that they generate, or the mood they curate, or the sense that there's kind of sense that there's an anarchic, and kind of an anarchic energy, kind of, or a place or a mood in the atmosphere. What that will lead to, you know, we can only guess at slightly fretfully. But that, I think, that atmosphere, I think, is certainly. I think even I can say it's even, perhaps even infiltrating the novel and whatever I'm working on at the moment. It's there because it does. I feed off it, and I think, and it feeds into my work as well on some point. So, not the particular event, but
the kind of Weltschmerz, just to use a German word.
Yeah, kind of the mood they create. It just seeps. It all just seeps and becomes like a sediment instead of just like the sediment to the work that you're working on.
I'm very conscious that we talked. Sorry about. 3 years ago when you just won the EUPL at Edinburgh Book Festival, and I was kind of buoyant. We talked with a Hungarian and a Danish writer who was also on the panel, and I don't think we could have perhaps foreseen what was going to happen in the next 3 years.
No.
Perhaps we were a bit complacent, who knows. But just in terms of yourselves, going back to yourselves as writers who've been shortlisted for and won prizes, how does winning, you know, more than one prize, how does this affect you as writers? Does it, is it an impetus? I mean, obviously it buys you time, but what's the sort of main feature of, you know, getting those accolades, and especially, you know, if you've been shortlisted for the Man Booker, for example, which is probably.
I think it's like you said earlier about it sort of doesn't change. You've always, as a writer, got this sort of monkey of doubt on your shoulder about everything you write, and you know, you're always convincing yourself you're the worst person on earth and the worst writer on earth.
You've toured really down on yourself.
Well, I guess
the absence of ego.
I think that's what keeps you writing, isn't it? Like, you know, finishing one book and going, that's not what I meant, like, and it's really irritating because I spent ages on it. And then so you start another one to try and say what you mean more succinctly, and then it goes off somewhere else. And I can see how it looks like it should give you confidence. Not to be too kind of brutal about it, but the money is the thing that really counts.
And
that
I didn't want to kind of
literally buys you
vulgar.
Yeah, literally buys you the time to write. And that is, I mean, if I hadn't won the John Llewellyn Rhys on
which
my first novel,
extinct,
yeah,
as a prize.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have been able to write my second book. There's no way I would have had the time or the money. I would have been straight back in PC world.
Right.
Yeah, there's a sense that each book, I can't remember who said, each book you write is an apology for the one you wrote before. And I definitely kind of recognise that. And I think that continues.
There are lots of writers who actually disown their first novels, quite famous ones. And certain writers pretended that she's never actually published her first novel. I'm not going to say who it is, but perhaps you can all take a guess. I think as well that you've both, interestingly, I think it's just fallen out that way, that you both published your first books around the same time, mm-hmm. and you both won similar awards, same awards, in fact. And do you ever feel, you know, you've had that time, but do you feel, how much pressure do you feel about, you know, have you felt pressure about the next book, the next? Well, we talked about this quite a bit downstairs, about how you fit that in. Mm. And, you know, a lot of writers churn out a book a year. I'm not naming any names, but they do.
Well, I think we were talking earlier about how we both have about 3 or 4 years between novels, and that's because... for me, it's because I don't know what I'm writing when I sit down to write. I think on the page and I change my mind and I rewrite, and it's about meditating on something for 3 or 4 years so that you can have some kind of truth in it, rather than working out a plot and then kind of sticking to that. I think the worst bit of advice I ever got before I ever started to attempt to write a novel was write 1 to 32 in a margin, then write one sentence about what happens before you start.
Who gave you that? Was that on your...
It was on a creative writing course. I won't name her, because she's still working. But it made me go, well, I can't write a novel. I couldn't think of 32 things. Like, you know, because how do you kind of hold a plot in your head? I don't know, for me it all has to go on the page, and when you're working on a laptop, which I do, it's very difficult to keep in mind that your novel is bigger than the size of the screen, and you have to kind of, it's a big old mess that I have to get lost in, and building the novel is really finding my way out of that mess. Mm. So that's what takes me such a long time.
Well, you were saying that there's going to be a longer gap. But in fact, you know, your shockingly writing career didn't start with a creative writing course, or even really with you know, studying literature itself. I'm saying shockingly, I kind of inverted the commas.
It started with reading. So
yeah.
So I guess it's
the best
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I guess how all writing careers really start. I was a big... I was a late reader, but once I started, there was kind of no stopping me. And then very quickly started trying to write a novel, but I don't feel any external pressure. Perhaps like you know, you put enough pressure on yourself to produce, you know, a novel that you're not embarrassed to publish. Really. Mm. And that's it. So, and I don't think any external pressure will match that pressure you have on yourself to write a book. And it takes me 4 or 5 years between books. Because you see, you just don't know what you're writing for the first year and a half. That's that done. And then I'll write 30,000 words, decide it's wrong, jack that in, start again. And then, you know, so I'm already in year two, year three, and then, you know, spend a year, 18 months writing first draft, edit it, then a year to publish it. 5 years go like anything, and before you know it, it's kind of sad to think if I carry on these 5 year interludes, I've only got probably six or seven novels in me. So
yeah, but maybe that's enough. Obviously I'm not trying to stop you writing novels, but I mean, as I said, I think some people perhaps produce, you know, the Joyce Carol Oates kind of machine. Vince has more than one of her.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Going back to the translation, there was a much quoted event, I don't know if anyone was at the Hay Festival this week, in which Britain's increasing linguaphobia, as it's called, is becoming more marked. You know, we're a very monolingual country in terms of learning languages at school, because there isn't actually... it's not mandatory to take a language at GCSE anymore. And also less than 4% of books published in the UK are in translation. Why do you think it's so low? I mean, we've talked a little bit about the snobbery. And how do you think we can kind of...
I went to a festival in Serbia called Kikinda Short Story Festival, and it was the most amazing, I think, answering like, what can we do? This just seems like the perfect model. There were 30 writers, short story writers from all over the world reading. Wow. For like, there were two events, we were there for a week, two events, and each event was hours long because it's just person after person getting up on stage and reading in their own language. And then there was, English was projected, so you could read along or you could just listen. And it was absolutely fascinating.
And what was the audience size?
Huge, huge audiences. I mean, like hundreds of people. And it was a real festival feeling. It was like joy and excitement and music afterwards. Everyone was trashed, and it was just like, and it was a festival that's happening with barely any funds. Like, we were staying in really like a hotel that hadn't been open since the 80s, and they just opened it just for us, and it's just a building full of pigeons. But it was just like such an exciting thing to be part of, because it was persevering despite no money, despite the fact that, you know, talking to Serbian publishers and agents and just how differently it works there, that a literary agent there has to have another job. Mm. They're a literary agent on the side as a hobby because you make no money at all. And I suppose it's, I don't know, making enthusiasm is, I think, what we need.
And yet it's interesting because we're absolutely awash with literary agents and publishers and book festivals and book prizes. Mm. So where do you think the joy's gone? Do you think it's much of an industry?
The London Book Fair isn't the most joyful event. I mean, it's fine, but it feels quite like a careers fair.
It is, and I've been to European book fairs and they're much more interesting.
Yeah, I was in Lithuania for their book fair a few months ago, and it encourages kids to come along and like it's like a day out for everyone, as well as a trade thing. And it felt, I don't know, it just felt like again enthusiasm, a sort of, rather than just straight business.
And attention, they're good. For example, prizes like you got the attention in the UK that they ought to get by the press. So I mean, in the UK, it feels to me like slightly sad that literary fiction and how literary fiction is spoken about in the year is kind of dominated by who's on what prize shortlist. And it tends to be one or two prizes that get all the sort of the press attention. And I think if we had a slightly more, or a much more perhaps kind of stronger literary culture, or a better conversation throughout the year about literature in the way, for example, there is about TV, for example. Mm. I mean, it's a much smaller, you know, thing literature compared to do. But if there was a much stronger kind of literary conversation throughout the land, throughout the year, we wouldn't be so hung up about one or two prizes and who's on what prizes. There's often talk about the book isn't on the prize shortlist, it hasn't worked or it's failed in some sense. And
there's always a roundup every year in the Guardian about what book worked and what book didn't.
And I think that's really damaging to talk about novels and books in that way. So I think the prizes are, you know, are great, and then unfortunately they're necessary. They're necessary because we don't have a strong enough literary conversation going on.
Unlike somewhere like our nearest neighbour in Ireland, for example, which
is much
absolutely steep.
Yes, that's a whole different thing.
I think we're kind of self-conscious, aren't we, perhaps, about literature. We're very concerned that literature isn't snobbish, it's accessible, and when it's on television, it's really done in a kind of cringe-worthy, embarrassing way.
Which they don't have in France, for example, where they're quite happy to have, you know, strong conversations about literature on TV. But in the UK, the anti-intellectualism, which has always been here, I guess, since Hogarth, pre-Hogarth, it's still there, and that kind of infects the way we we think about literature, I think, to a great extent. And also, you know, America's sort of hegemony, you know, we are living in kind of an American empire, probably the first empire that doesn't call itself an empire, but that kind of onto the translation question, that dominates kind of part of the reason why we do see so few works translated into English.
So that must have been quite refreshing for you to win this prize, because I guess, you know, when you're starting out as a writer, it's always that you must make it in America, you know, it's like being on tour with a band or something, you know, and it's to have this kind of different prize, which is going to, you know, your book is going to be seen by lots of different countries.
I mean, this was a really different and great prize because, you know, you're just told that you're one of 12 authors to be awarded it. So there isn't the kind of like the hoopla that goes along with some prizes where there's a long list and a whittling down till you get, you know, the drama.
Just to say that, no, we don't reveal the shortlist for this prize. Great writers on the shortlist. And actually the people judging the prize, they're not told what books to judge. All the judges bring their own knowledge of literature and their own books. And the stipulation is it has to be a writer who has published not less than 2 and not more than 4 novels. Sorry, in short.
Yeah, so there isn't that sort of that hoopla or that kind of circus around it in the way that, but I suppose that's part of the reason perhaps it doesn't get the attention that those prizes that have that do. But also, so but you're just one of like 12 groups of writers, and there's a really nice feeling when you're in a room, when you're with these other writers for 3 or 4 days, and you get to know each other and get to know each other's works, and it's a different feeling. See, it feels quite a lot of camaraderie in the group I was with. I don't know what your group was like.
Very nice.
Now, Adam Fold said the same. It's time to move to questions.
Hi, thank you. I just have a question for Evie. I'm not sure I understood well, but I was very impressed by the way you describe your writing process. So can you elaborate on that? Did I get it well that you're saying that when you write, you don't always have a precise plan? Mm. I would like to hear more about that.
I don't even have a vague plan when I start writing. I think that's one of the things that sort of calms me down when I finish one book and I have to write another one, is that every time my process has been just sit at the desk and write, and what the thing that you're interested in kind of comes to the surface after a certain amount of words. So what I tend to do is write 30 to 40,000 words and then see what I've got and see if there's something that is sort of repeating. And then I kind of cut that down lots and sort of write over the top of it. And now I'm at about 70,000 words and I'm kind of confused about the structure. So I've got all these different threads and strands, and it's putting them in order that that kind of shows me what the plot is, sort of, and sort of tells me what the ending can be. It sounds like a mess, and it is a mess, but it's sort of like, it's a reassuring thing that it's, whenever it feels too neat, I know it's not any good, it's too sort of packed, and feels like I haven't thought about it deeply enough if it's too simple. If it's something you can say in a sentence that your book's about, I feel like I have not done the job in 3 years that I should have. But there's a lot of cutting on the floor.
We're lucky to have you because you're about a month from...
Yeah. Yeah, so then also part of my process is just really ignoring it a lot when the deadline comes along. And not sitting at the desk.
You said you're a little bit behind. I don't understand the writers on social media who inform people of every stage of their book.
It seems like such a terrible idea. I think anytime I think I'm coming to an end, I'm not. So I have to have my agent say, you need to show me it now and you're probably finished, because I'll keep on writing books over the top of other books. It's a stupid way of doing it, really.
No, I think that's everybody's different process. Have we got another question? Yes, there, please.
Do you get involved much in your translations? And having now been an author in translation, does it make you view translated works into English differently?
With some translations, I have been involved because the translators needed clarification. So the Italian one, there's been lots of back and forth with the translator, because I use lots of Punjabi phrases in this book. And but with others, nothing at all, and I don't really know it's the translation's finished until the book one day lands through my letterbox. So does it make you view work translated English differently? I think perhaps it does. I think perhaps I'm more notice more kind of variations in register or tone, which perhaps I wouldn't have previously, because I've seen that process. I've seen the translation process with my own work. I can see if the translation had gone this way, it would have sounded like this, and which would have been off. So I think perhaps I can think of a couple of novels I read recently when I thought, that's an odd change in tone. Is that the translator? Was that in the book? And I'll never know. But perhaps I've got more of an eye for that than I did have previously, I think.
Yeah, I think I've met a couple of my translators. I've met my French translator, who has really spent about a year, I think, going back and forth, lots and lots of questions. And I remember there was one in particular where I described someone with cheesy teeth, and she was like, the thing is, this is France, so I need to know what kind of cheese.
And it has to be a French cheese.
Yeah. But then I went to Bulgaria to meet my Bulgarian publisher, and my translator was there. And he was fascinating. He'd learnt English through watching Yes Minister and Only Fools and Horses, and he was just, he had all of these box sets, and he was just like quoting, Rodney, and I know that he translated my work really, really quickly, and I wish I could read it, because I'm so fascinated by that kind of, that tone that he would use.
That vernacular will have gone straight into Bulgarian. What's the weirdest translated title that you've had that's kind of... Because I know a lot of writers are quite far away from their original titles sometimes.
Mine have all been pretty close to... So I know in Dutch Runaways, there wasn't a word that worked, so they used Luck Finders, which I thought was quite nice. People on search, which I think fits well with the idea of an economic migrant. So I thought that was a pretty translation.
Yours are quotations, your titles. So
the first one definitely is. So most of the time they just do the translation of that quote that's in their Bible. I think with All the Birds Singing, I think there's a nice one. I can't remember if it's the French one or which one it is, but it's All the Birds of the Sky, which is quite nice.
But it's not.
It's not, but it's maybe it's the next one.
Well, yeah. So do we have any more questions?
I was just wondering if either of you could give us some recommendations of books in translation that you've loved from the last year. You've both spoken a little bit about them, but I'm just intrigued to hear more about what you have to say.
It's not from the last year, but I recently read Agatha Christoph's The Notebook trilogy, and I really loved that. That's probably the last thing I've read in translation. It's not very up to date, but... Looks for bookshop staff. I don't know. I can't remember.
I'm sure the book's here, because there's a very good selection of translated literature on these shelves. How about you, Sanjeev? You talked about that wonderful Catalan novel as well.
Yeah, Death in Spring by Mercè Rodoredo. I think it's just come out this year, but I think it's an old novel from the 30s, which has been reissued.
I think Dawn Books are publishing it.
Might be. I can't remember the publisher. So that was really good. That's about this community in Spain, in Catalonia, who are just have these very strange rituals, and the story of a young man who's, I guess, is coming of age in that community, but at the same time, it's a story of Franco and the community under that kind of life, and it's very lush and bucolic and frightening, and I really loved it. So I recommend that, or anything by Jenny Erfenbeck as well. I think she's amazing.
Do we have any more questions?
Sorry, this is a multi-part question, so I don't want to be long-winded. But first of all, what do you have any views on aspiring writers attending writing workshops? Because I probably have attended too many. Some would say, write what you know. Others will say, do not write what you know. And I think the write what you know school, it's predicated on the fact that the first novel of any writer is sort of half autobiographical. But then I was listening to you saying you don't know, you have no plot, you just start with a blank page. So how do you start with the universe and then water it down to...
I know, right? I think the write what you know thing, it can slightly confuse people because it's like you can't, it suggests you can't write anything outside of your own experience. And I think emotionally you can know things.
Or that all fiction is autobiographical.
Yeah,
which is, again,
exactly.
Incorrect.
Yeah, I think it, I don't know, I think, I mean, I write a lot about monsters, which are not things I've encountered personally. And so I would say that write what you know is, I guess it's more write what you can imagine rather than write what you know. But don't, I guess that it's important that it's emotionally truthful. That's the important bit. It's not important whether it happened like that. I find a lot of students who are wanting to write about an event in their life, maybe a traumatic event, and fictionalise it, but they want to stick very firmly to the facts of what happened to them. And maybe that doesn't make the best story. And if it's fiction, it's quite often much more helpful to them if they can get out of their head that it has to be truthful in that way. But as long as it's truthful emotionally, blah, blah, blah. I don't know, what do you think?
No, I think... So you can know something emotionally, and even it might not, the biographical facts of this novel might not be your own particular life. The emotional posture of the book is usually very much your own, and that, for me, that's true in both my books to date. That's what, like you say, that's what it means for me to know something. Like, do I know it emotionally? Because I can't imagine how I'd write anything or any character that was completely like separate from that had nothing that had no overlap with me. I don't think I've got the imagination to do that. There would always have to be some part of me present. I don't know your first part about whether creative writing workshops are useful. I think for me, I think what they creative writing workshops or creative writing programs can do is they give you a time to write, and they give you a community of people that share your passion, and you know, that don't think it's silly to want to be a writer, or don't think it's frivolous or anything like that. And I think those are the two things that I think are really important about creative writing programs. I think I wish I had done one actually. I think I'd be a more sophisticated writer if I had.
So it might have taken even longer to write, maybe
would have got there sooner. So I think they can be worthwhile for the right person.
Yeah, but they're all so different. That's the other thing. It's about choosing the one that's right for you.
But you don't know until the end of it.
Yeah, and even then. But I think it's about taking yourself seriously for a year or something, and being like, no, my work is to write a story. That's not a hobby, that's my work. And a broad reading list is always useful, you know, being pointed at books that you wouldn't naturally go towards. But I'd say the best advice to any writer starting out is just to write. And it's a really boring bit of advice, but...
I think it was Nadine Gordimer who said the writer has to tell the truth as they see it as well, when you're just talking about what you keep in and what you leave out.
Yeah.
Do we have any final questions? Ah, there's one over there.
I bet your Bulgarian translator, who learned his English on Olive the Horses, I bet he couldn't believe his luck when he got to translate a writer from Peckham. Yeah. Did he realise it was a real place and not a fiction? Or did he want to come and do a field trip and sort of come and see where you lived? But I wanted to ask, what do you think it was about your books that was the sort of a... What is it in your books that meant it sort of had a European dimension or a European resonance sufficient for it to be chosen to win this prize? Mm-hmm. And when you were translated into other languages and you went and I guess spoke to people who'd read your work through other languages, mm-hmm. did they see things in it or react to things in it that were unexpected to you or that you hadn't expected? Yeah, they hadn't expected.
Well, the first part of the question, so it's a book in two, it's got two narratives, and the other one is set in the UK. So I guess that's the... But it's an Australian woman, so it's a UK landscape, and it's very much about the landscape. To be honest, when I've been out there with my publishers when I was in Bulgaria and in Lithuania, the book had just published, so it was more about introducing the book to people. But I had my translator was just like, my translator obviously in Bulgaria sees the humour and stuff, and he was like, it's a really funny book. And the Lithuanian one was, it's a really dark book. So it's kind of, it's interesting. I don't know, again, that is so down to the translator. And I don't know. I think that's been a really, really interesting thing, meeting people, especially my French translator, who I feel like, I almost feel like her name ought to be on the front cover, at least as large as mine, because the decisions she has to make about which are the right words, you know, she is writing a novel in a way, you know.
And dual authorship, as it's often been described.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the judges saw from a European perspective to award the prize. That's Catherine. But I guess there's, you know, elements of migration and refugees, which I suppose is there on the continent as much as, yeah, more so than here. Did the translators see it? I didn't get a sense that the European translations or the translators viewed the book radically differently to the British ones, but when I went to India and the way Indian critics and readers read the book compared to UK ones, is that Indian readers all really loved the part set in the UK, and so, you know, the Indian stuff was great, but the UK stuff was really exciting. That was great. Well, the UK writer, UK readers were all, oh, the UK stuff, you know, was a bit, but the India stuff was amazing. That was like really good. So that sense of just, you know, it's, you know, the topsy-turviness or wanting to kind of see the other, which is probably the other piece of what the book's about as well, you know, and how, you know, you perhaps don't recognise representations of yourself, but representation of the other. You kind of think you know more than you do, if that makes sense.
That's a great note to end on. I think Fran from EUPL wants to say a word.
Thank you very much to the three of you. And, I want to say a few words about this mysterious UPL you have heard about for the whole evening. I'm here representing the consortium, the European Union Prize for Literature, which is a consortium made by the European International Booksellers Federation, that's me, and then the Federation of European Publishers and the European Writers' Council. And for the last 10 years, actually, we're based in Brussels. We are umbrella organizations representing the trade and writers and looking after the interests of the book industry. And for the last 10 years, has been our great pleasure and privilege to be involved as well, in addition to other activities, in this EUPL prize. And this is why we have been granted some money from the European Commission to co-organize these events. And I want to thank very much the London Review of Books Bookshop, both of you, Evie and Sunjeev, and of course Catherine, for this wonderful evening, and wish you every success. And if I may add, if you were, I will anyway, you were wondering if they had an advice about a great book in translation, can I give you my advice? You should read Virginie Despentes, Vernon Subutex. She has just been translated into English. It's a fantastic read. It's a trilogy, it's fantastic. It's about the life of a CD right, a seller, it was not CDs, it was music seller in Paris in the 70s. It's a trilogy, Virginie Despentes, Vernon Subutex. You will have a ball. Not that they're not great writers, but please all read that. I have to promote this writer because she's fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Fran. And thanks, Sanjeev and Evie. I'm just going to round the applause.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.